They were three ordinary women on what seemed like a simple mission to find a film they liked. One where women got something to do and not just look pretty or be murdered, which, to be totally honest, has complicated matters a bit. Welcome to Flicking. Yes, it sounds a bit rude. That's the joke.
Hello and welcome to March's Flicking, our monthly look at a film that came out in 2023, where we share our thoughts on how that went for everyone involved. I am joined, as ever, by that Hannah Dunleavy. Hannah, hello.
Hello.
You don't usually get to go first, do you? You seem
no,
surprised.
No, I was a bit thrown.
And indeed by Yosra Osman. Yosra, hello.
Hello. It's nice because I've got Hannah's hello to go off of. I don't have to be creative when I'm second.
Just say hello, guys. It's fine.
I know.
It shouldn't
be
this pressure.
Oh, my God, we've fallen at the first hurdle.
Fucking hell. Hannah, what did you have us watching this month?
Well, because everybody knew that Oppenheimer was going to clean up at the Oscars, I decided that we should watch Oppenheimer. And it cleaned up at the Oscars. I mean, it did go very well for everyone involved.
It did. It really did.
13 nominations, 7 wins. I saw a headline saying it was one of the most successful. I mean, it was one of the most successful films ever at the Oscars, but that it was one of the most successful films because it did really well at the box office. And films that do well at the Oscars don't always do that. I would argue that Titanic did that, but actually, Oppenheimer won more of the better respected awards, like the acting awards. Maybe better respected's not the right word. Apologies if you're in makeup or costume design.
The headline awards.
Headline awards.
That would be the word
I was looking for. Obviously, Cillian Murphy won and Robert Downey Jr. We can discuss those in there. But there were other great performances. Mickey, this is the first time you've watched it. Yosra, I know you've seen this before. And I have also seen it before at the cinema. Yosra, was this a film that you rushed to see at the cinema?
I'm going to say yes, but I think that's partly, it's interesting because it came out the same day as Barbie. So that, for cinema fans, was a huge, huge day. I think Barbenheimer single-handedly saved cinema because I went and saw both films back to back. I started with Oppenheimer and then I went to see Barbie, which I think is the right order. So it was a really important cinema day for me. And, you know, when you went, there were tons of people there. And it's interesting, I do wonder if Barbie hadn't come out at the same time, would Oppenheimer have done as well in terms of its box office draw, in terms of the number of people going to see it? And the more I think about it, the more I'm not sure. But that's a separate thing. But yes, I was really, really keen to see it, especially because Nolan, I don't know if either of you saw Tenet, his previous film. Oh gosh, that one went way over my head. I did not enjoy that at all. So this one had a really big kind of, it had a bigger push. There was a lot there that I thought I would admire. So yeah, I was looking forward to it.
In a lot of ways, I was going to say that it's Christopher Nolan's The Straight Story, in that it's a Christopher Nolan film, but it's the least Christopher Nolan of all his films.
Yeah.
Which might explain why it's one of his more popular ones, because it's not impenetrable.
I don't know, he did do Batman as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I was thinking more of Tenet and the films along those lines. Mickey, you didn't go to see it at the cinema. You didn't fall for that Barbieheimer nonsense.
Barbenheimer did appeal to me, but as previously discussed on this particular podcast, I don't like people at the cinema. And so that is what will always put me off going to see stuff at the cinema. I just get really annoyed with the distractions of other people. And it felt like a film that I would have to concentrate on, which did turn out to be the case.
Interestingly, I mentioned it already. I was listening to Titanic, that is. I was listening to The Rest Is History this week, and they were talking about the sinking of the Titanic, and naturally they were talking about James Cameron's film. And they said something that I'd forgotten, which was that in the lead-up to Titanic getting made, coming out, and all of that, everybody expected it to be a flop. And that was because there was something about the hubris of making it and the message of hubris that's already attached to the Titanic. Mm. It seemed like ironic and fitting, and I'd actually forgotten that. But you can actually argue that with this film, I think, in the sense of the message about Oppenheimer's always been just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
You kind of wonder that the message that was attached to this film was just because you can doesn't mean it should. And I kind of was dreading it because I thought, if this is a great story done in an impenetrable way, I'm going to be really annoyed. And what struck me on the second watch is about the first 20 minutes when I was watching it the second time, I was like, man, why did I think this film was really good? Because I really sort of struggled with the first 20 minutes. And I'd obviously forgotten that the first time, or it didn't happen the first time. And then there just got to be a point where I was like, okay, I'm in this. I've worked out what's going on, at what point, how the stories intersect with each other, and now I'm in it. Not that that was that complicated, but when things do leap around in time so much as they do at the start of this, it is hard to get your bearings.
I totally agree, Hannah. And this was the first time I saw it, I felt this. That first half an hour or so, I couldn't work out quite what was going on when, because you're not that you have to be told, but it was difficult to sense because there's three parts to this, aren't there? There's the kind of background to Oppenheimer, there's the bit where he's doing the testing of the atomic bomb, and then obviously what happens, and then there's the courtroom saga, but it kind of jumbles around. And I remember thinking when I came out of the cinema, I was quite confused. But I wonder if it's because, Hannah, I think this is a better film to go at the cinema, so maybe you feel more immersed in it at the cinema. So when you're watching it the second time, and I'm assuming you watched it at home, some of the, I don't want to say faults, maybe came through a bit more.
I am really glad that you have both said that, because I watched this in two halves, just because that was the time I had. So I watched it across two nights. And the first half, certainly the first, I'd say, 40 minutes, made me feel stupid. And I am not stupid. But there was a lot going on. It is a very rich pudding, right? And that pudding is made up mainly of physics, which is not my strong pudding. But I was jumping my way through it, just going, I don't understand. And it wasn't so much the moving around in time. I understood that. I could follow that. Because they do use different filming techniques, and a lot of it is in black and white. So I'm like, oh, that's where we are, because we're in black and white. And obviously, Cillian Murphy looks various different ages throughout. But yeah, I felt really stupid for basically the first part of this. But what I think might be the case is the second half, having split it literally an hour and a half, is so fucking good. It's so good that I did forget that I'd had to struggle through quite a lot to get there. And that to me means it could have maybe been better edited. I'm always saying this to Christopher Nolan. He doesn't take any fucking notice. But yeah, I found it too long, because if the second half is so dramatically better for me than the first half, then I think there could have been a bit more left on the cutting room floor, maybe.
I wonder if it's partly a narrative thing, though, because you're right, you can tell it's three different parts, but I wasn't sure what parts were, essentially. I think for me, in that first half an hour, the courtroom bit, I didn't know who was who and how that related to Oppenheimer. As in, when you move through the film, you start to understand who these people are and what's happening. Uh-huh. So I think that's why I got... Look, I do agree with you, Mickey, that the second half is a lot stronger narratively. It's tighter. It's a better watch.
I mean, it's got more bang for your buck, which, as we know, being the basic bitch that I am, I'm a big fan of.
Now, you knew that the bang was coming later than the explosion, because I told you, Mickey, about when I saw this in the cinema. Because it really is. It's probably about 30 seconds. Yeah. I should have timed it.
Big delay.
Enough time for you to forget, not forget that the bomb's gone off, but certainly forget that you haven't heard a noise. And when that bang went off, which in the cinema was room-shakingly loud, the man in the seat next to my friend Nick screamed all bore and like did that shook in his seat thing, and then we lost the next 5 minutes to laughing, like him included as well. He thought it was really, really funny that he'd done it. But that, it still remains remarkably effective, the delay between the explosion and then hearing the bang.
Yeah, and the other effects of it as well, not just the noise, but the kind of backdraft, probably not a technical term around bombs, but the kind of impact that they still get from that far away. 10 miles away, are they? Like a long way away, with the wind that hits them as well, the force of that.
Now, obviously, I said this got the more marquee awards. Let's start with Cillian Murphy, and I think he's phenomenal in this. I will say I would have really liked to see Paul Giamatti win, because he was brilliant in The Holdovers, but I know that that wasn't going to happen. He definitely had this in the bag. Robert Downey Jr. I'm a bit more circumspect about, to be honest, because since he played Tony Stark, Robert Downey Jr. seems to always play a version of Tony Stark, and it gets on my tits. I would say there are other performances here that I enjoyed a lot more than his if there was going to be a best supporting actor. And it's an embarrassment of riches. I mean,
it really is.
Even in tiny, tiny like roles, guys that I absolutely, and it is almost completely guys that I absolutely love, Jason Clarke,
oh, he's
David
so good.
Brummel, Rami Malek, like just proper, Gary Oldman, proper quality people in this. So let's start. Cillian Murphy, yours, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, it was always going to be Cillian Murphy's award, wasn't it? And it's just funny because I'm just going through that list. I remember when we saw it at the cinema, we made jokes and we commented, it's basically like a who's who of famous white male actors. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But I do think Cillian Murphy is really, really deserving in this role. I mean, there is so much that goes on behind those eyes. And when we're thinking about the moral complexities of a character like Oppenheimer, without him actually saying much, he gets quite a lot across. And there are some absolutely brilliant shots of him. So for me, I do think Cillian Murphy deserves this. I loved Paul Giamatti, but this feels like a magnum opus. But this feels like his film. And it's so good to see him getting that award's attention.
Yeah, he's brilliant in it. He's really engaging and he carries so much of it. And as Yosra has just said, that the whole moral complexity of it does seem to fall on his shoulders to get across this whole, what the fuck have I done? Well, you said at the top, Hannah, that Jeff Goldblum Jurassic Park line, you know, we knew we could, but yeah, should we?
There's a picture of Oppenheimer on the guy from Seinfeld, who is in Jurassic Park, has a picture of Oppenheimer.
Oh, Newman.
On his computer, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. So no, that is phenomenal. Also, the first Irish-born actor to win an Oscar, so that's really good.
Yeah,
it's a nice thing.
Yeah. Why hasn't Richard Harris got one?
I can't answer. They will not let me on the board, Hannah. I will keep writing in though.
What about my more scathing assessment of Robert Downey Jr.?
Oh, I totally agree. I love Robert Downey Jr. and I love Iron Man and I love him as Iron Man, as Tony Stark, sorry, but I couldn't get past that it was Iron Man as I was watching it. And I felt like I was going a bit mad as I saw him getting all this awards attention. I was like, oh, I missed something here. But I don't mean to be mean. It's just, perhaps it's because he is such a well-respected actor. And in the awards game, there's this talk of sort of deserving actors that haven't won anything yet. But then they're in a film with such awards attention as Oppenheimer that it's sort of their time. And I think that might be what happened with Downey Jr. here, but I think there are great performances all round.
Do you know, there's also the opposite in, and I want to bring him up because he's much maligned. In fact, he appears to be Keira Knightley for men, which is Matt Damon. Like, men don't seem to like Matt Damon. I don't know why, but in the same way that women don't seem to like Keira Knightley, and I can't really explain why. But I think and obviously the whole
Matt Damon,
which people will always be associated with. I think when he's good, he's really, really good. And I think this is one of those occasions. I think he's great in it.
I think he's really powerful in this. Just to go back to Downey Jr., I think he's brilliant in this. And I really enjoyed his performance. I have never seen Iron Man, though. So maybe that is,
yeah,
why I thought it was so good.
I feel
so
it is quite reductive. And I don't mean to be reductive, but it's just, I couldn't escape it when I was watching it. But that doesn't mean he was bad. It's just I couldn't see past the fact that he was totally dark.
I think also because Tony Stark, you know, he's funny, he's nonconformist, he's like a lot of things. He's kind of what you think Robert Downey Jr. is like himself. So it then starts to feel like Robert Downey Jr. is just playing himself or a variation. And actually, I'm sure that's not true. But I just think he used to be cast in much, much more interesting roles. Let me think of something off the top of my head now. Wonder Boys. He's absolutely amazing in Wonder Boys. And I just can't imagine him playing that character again. He just seems to play sort of rich, powerful man now.
It's not an uninteresting role, though.
No, it's not.
Again, the rich pudding analogy. Like, there's a lot that guy is getting across, that Strauss is getting across, that he has done. The manipulation. And I think he does get that across. He's immediately unlikable, though, which maybe gives the game away a little bit if you're not someone who has done your research on the history of the story or the kind of genesis of the story. I was like, I don't trust this guy. As soon as like Robert Downey Jr. turned up, I was like, what's going on here? Why is he in black and white? This is suspicious.
I said this when I was talking to Helen Lewis about how old Joe Biden was, back when I was talking to her about don't know, something brilliant she was doing, no doubt. And the scene where they come in and say, like, there was this one guy, some new young guy, and it turns out to be JFK, obviously.
Yes. Yeah.
But my head went, oh, I wonder if it's Biden. And then I thought, he's not that old. It's like, come on, Anna, how old do you think he is? Not that old.
One more man that I think is some absolutely left field casting. Tom Conti as Einstein. Could not get my head around it, I'm afraid.
His hair was a bit too much.
It was a bit too Einstein, wasn't it? It's like they've gone for some sort of pantomime Einstein.
But the thing is, I suppose, how do you not?
Yeah,
how do you...
that was his hair.
I mean, yeah, it was his hair. How do you not look like you go to a fancy dress party when you're dressed up as as Albert Einstein? I don't know.
Cast Tom Conti. And this feels really mean because he was great, but I was just like, it's Tom Conti, isn't it?
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much, that does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard.
So we talked about the men. Contrarily, there's not a lot of women in this. I like the women in this, Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt. I think they're both great. They both make a decent fist of pretty nothingy really roles. It doesn't bother me that there aren't a huge amount of women in this, unless I then go on to discover that there were, in fact, more women working on the Manhattan Project than there were men. Then I'd be annoyed. But...
yeah. There was just the one, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think it's probably representative of what it actually looked like in politics and science in that period.
For sure. It's not being sexist by leaving women out. It's just representative of how that time in history was.
Yes, ma'am.
So I'm going to disagree slightly because I think one of my biggest bugbears with this film are the women, and not necessarily Blunt and Pugh's performances, but how they are written. I think there could have been more complexity to their characters.
I feel like
Nolan, he's not always great with women in his films, and that for me in Oppenheimer, and you know, you're watching Oppenheimer, you're expecting it to be very male dominated, but I just think there could be more done with the women in this film, and Florence Pugh in particular. I mean, for me, there were some just gratuitous bits of her sitting topless with Oppenheimer. I'm
agreed.
Like, why have we got this in here?
Yeah.
Like,
she's a sexy communist, Yosra. Come on.
Come on. It's just things like that really got on my nerves. Yeah, that's what I'll say on that.
No, I mean, I agree. I think they were good. They did well with what they were given. They weren't given much.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly.
Christopher, women and Edison, come on. But also, like, Emily Blunt picked up quite a few awards as well, and I was left a bit like, for what? Is it, you know, they wanted to mention Best Supporting Actress in Oppenheimer, and they have very little to choose from. But when she's on the screen, I think she is quite formidable. The bit in the not courtroom where she is being questioned. I think she's absolutely cracking. But it's what, 3 minutes of a 3-hour film?
Yeah. I'm just going to say it because I think you can still watch it on the iPlayer. Hugo Blick's The English, which was really underwatched, but was absolutely freaking marvellous. She is so great in that. It's about a woman who's going across America for an unknown purpose in the old days, and she's really, really good in it. Yeah, give her something really worthwhile to do, and she's brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, so in honour of Devine Joy Randolph, who won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar, which was well deserved. So in honour of that, I'm going to ask a question that she asked in Only Murders in the Building, which is, you need to know the who, the how, the why, and the why now. And so I just wondered, why now? What do you think Oppenheimer says about now? What do you think he was trying to say? Why do you think nobody's made this film before now? I mean, witch hunts, right? I'm guessing. Cancel culture. I don't know. There must be something in that. Is there? I don't know.
I think witch hunts and cancel culture is a good call, but we're also at a very big crossroads as a species, aren't we? When it comes
Absolutely.
To climate change.
AI and
energy. Yeah. I think when people think of nuclear energy, we are very much coloured by this idea of nuclear power being destructive and indeed a bit leaky. Thanks to the atomic bomb and to Chernobyl and other disasters, we're quite frightened of it as an energy source. So the timing on that is also a little bit interesting because I think it'll make people quite understandably frightened of it again. But yeah, I feel like we're maybe not just one crossroads, so many crossroads as a yeah. species, and it absolutely picks up on all of those.
I guess he's just a difficult person to portray because there are so many things, like you mentioned cancel culture, but you know, how do you portray that perspective of what he did and what the implications of that have been? And I'm not saying Nolan got it perfectly right, but there is a clear understanding of the sensitivities and, as we talked about before, the moral complexities. I think that's a really difficult one. Like, you don't want to look with a film like this. It's clear, for example, that the atomic bomb, it was wrong what happened. But he doesn't portray Oppenheimer in a very one-dimensional way. And actually, that's quite interesting, that kind of look at Oppenheimer as a figure. And I'm not sure many people might want to touch that, really. It's a difficult area.
I'd be interested to know what kind of reception the film has had in Japan.
Yeah. Sorry, I probably should have Googled that. Yeah, that is interesting. Well, I mean, I actually had at your house, Vicky, quite a forthright debate with Alfred Chang about the dropping of the bomb after we both saw this, because I continue to believe that it was really complicated and that, you know, counterfactuals are very difficult. Would it have been better to fight their way to Japan in terms of loss of life? I think we don't know. We actually don't know that. Fun fact, although it's not fun at all, if you get a Purple Heart today in America, you're getting a Purple Heart that was manufactured in 1945 in anticipation of an invasion of Japan, because that's how many people they thought they were going to lose. It is absolutely massive, the loss of life would have been. However, the loss of civilian life, you know, the loss of cultural life that happened because of the bomb, but also where the bomb moved us next, the actual effects of dropping the bomb and where it took us is awful. So I remain still quite conflicted. Jane is less conflicted, which is why we ended up having a fun and forthright debate.
She's like, no, bomb everyone. No, she's not. She's very anti the bomb.
Jane was very much like, it was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't feel like I'm in a position to say whether I think it was wrong yet. But it did inspire that conversation. So I suppose it'd be interesting to know if other people are talking about it outside of this as well.
Oppenheimer's optimism isn't quite the right word, but sort of faith in humanity that when this gets dropped, it means that people will be so unwilling to do it ever, ever again, kind of has a logic to it. I mean, he's a scientist. It absolutely has a logic to it that hasn't kind of borne fruit because humans.
Yeah, that'd be dated.
Yeah,
the dated scenario.
But you can see where he's coming from. You know, I understand his working out, and you kind of want it to be true, because there was no doubt, I think, with the absolute benefit of hindsight, that they were going to drop those bombs. They were going to drop them. That, like, you know, he's very naive to think that they're not going to at any point. That why else are they making them?
Yeah.
But Yeah, I just wish it had borne fruit because it kind of makes sense as an argument. But yeah, humans.
When we first went to see it, a lot of what was talked about at the time, maybe not so much now, was around, again, the kind of perspectives of the dropping of the atomic bomb. There's very little reference in terms of the Japanese civilians that were killed. And even the scene where you see the utter destruction that happened, you're looking at Oppenheimer's reaction to it. I'm not saying it had to be like that, but I do wonder if there was an expectation that there would be something more there, and that's why people have questioned it since. And I'm not 100% sure of Japanese audiences' reaction to that, but this is all very centered on Oppenheimer and on the US, and perhaps it's not going into too much into, despite us all knowing and it being quite into that other perspective of the people who face the destruction of this.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Yasra, the way you've just articulated that. I agree. And it's the film is called Oppenheimer. We're focused on this individual, but also we get to know various other individuals around him. But he is literally the titular character. And what we get about the people killed in Japan are numbers. And it's much easier to be objective about numbers, right? It's very hard to kind of imagine that sort of scale of destruction. But where we're talking about an individual and his downfall and the machinations that are meaning that he is facing this, by any other word, trial or witch hunt, it's much more engaging, isn't it? It's much more subjective. So yeah, it does feel perhaps an injustice that they are numbers as opposed to any kind of subjective look at the huge loss of life that this caused.
In a way, it reminded me, obviously, they have their differences of what happened to Alan Turing. So it's also a kind of a marker or a sign that you can be the very best at what you do in the entire world, and you can give your all to your country and they can still stab you in the back.
Totally.
They can still just take it all away from you, or try to take it all away from you, or kill you, which is essentially what happened to Alan Turing.
He's absolutely made a scapegoat, but not for the thing that he feels morally conflicted about. It's for his unwillingness to create more bombs. That's what he ends up being the scapegoat for, right?
Well, I mean, it's also just the absolute rampant obsession with communism that America had in the Cold War, which was just, I mean, there's loads and loads of really good films about that. Like Good Night and Good Luck off the top of my head.
It's about his political influence, really, isn't it? That's what they take major objection to, that kind of steers that whole security hearing.
I don't know. And again, like, this is, like I say, it made me feel stupid, so I might well be getting this wrong, but I don't feel like the hearing would have happened if he'd just gone along with them making the hydrogen bomb. They wouldn't have
I'm sure somebody might have stepped in sooner and said, what, you persecuted him for? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, final question. Would you watch it again?
No. No. I mean, it looks incredible. That's another thing to say about it. It is actually, like, beautiful to watch. It's so gorgeously filmed. The performances are all incredible. But yeah, I've seen it now. I don't need to spend another 3 hours. I'd maybe watch the second half again, but only if it was on.
Yeah, actually, that's pretty much my answer, I would say. Because 3 hours is a long time to commit to anything.
It really is.
It's a long time. Yeah, I've seen it twice now, and I think I'm good with it. Appreciate the craft, but I'm good.
Thanks, Christopher. We're all full of that pudding.
I will say, I'm really glad I got to see it for the first time in the cinema, because watching it at the cinema, it was just such an experience. So that was really cool.
Do you think I missed out by watching it on the telly?
Well, yes, I would say. But yes, in general, specifically you, maybe not, since you don't really like going to the
cinema. Yeah, if you don't like going to the cinema, then.
Okay, thank you.
But it felt more immersive watching it at the cinemas.
It felt like my ears were bleeding at points in the cinema, I have to say. And I have a hearing problem, so Christ knows what it was like for people who can actually hear.
Yeah, I don't know that that's made me feel like I've missed out, if I'm honest with you.
What are we doing next time?
So next time, Yosri, you might have seen this. Hannah, I don't think you have. But I picked a film that came out in 2023. It's only just come out in this country, but has already scooped an Oscar as well. And like, there's a lot of chatter about its feminist credentials, and I'm interested to find out whether Poor Things is worthy of the chatter.
Oh,
we will have a good conversation about that one.
I think so, yeah. Because yes, I think I already know.
Yep. Oh, that's going to be interesting.
Standard issue for all women.